Thank you, Dean Moore, for your introduction, and thank you to you and to President Moeller for the opportunity to serve on this faculty. And to my faculty colleagues, it's a pleasure to serve alongside of you. I would prefer that one of you were up here right now so I could listen to you. And for any staff that are here, I just wanted to say thank you to you for keeping this place running and for all that you do. You are greatly appreciated. To students, I'm ever grateful that God has called you here and that you have come. A professor at a different institution once remarked of his institution that this is such a lovely place when the students aren't here. That is not our sentiment. We are here because of you. Most of all, I want to express thanks to and for my children, and especially my wife, Catherine, who cannot be here this morning because of her work schedule, but without whose support and encouragement, I would not be where I am. So I want to speak to the issue of having children technically, or assisted reproductive technologies. On the 25th of July, 1978, in Kershaw's Cottage Hospital in Oldham, Lancashire, in England, Louise Brown was born. With her was born a new era in making babies. Thus began what Peter Singer and Dean Wells referred to as the reproduction revolution, for this marked the first time a human being was born after having been conceived outside of the human body via in vitro fertilization, or IVF. It was as a seminary student that I was first struck by the significance of what was then commonly referred to as new reproductive technologies. On the one hand, it was difficult not to marvel at what could be done to overcome infertility. From modest beginnings with artificial insemination, the technological possibilities had exploded, and the problem of infertility was confronted by a dazzling array of assisted reproductive technologies, or ARTs, including IVF and GIFT, or gamete intrafallopian transfer, ZIFT, zygote intrafallopian transfer, ICSI, intracytoplasmic sperm injection, and assisted hatching, to name a few things. Yet my interest was not primarily with what could be done, but rather with what should be done to overcome infertility. The science was intriguing, but I was in seminary because I wanted to understand everything, including science and technology, in light of God's word and a Christian worldview. The moral debate about ARTs influenced my understanding of Christian ethics for at least three reasons. First, it illustrated the breadth of Christian ethics, which, grounded in the Bible and theology, intersects with philosophy, science, medicine, politics, and other fields, and is at the center of many challenges and opportunities in pastoral ministry. Second, the debate indicated the importance of moral reasoning and the relation between reflection and deliberation. For it was evident that one's judgment about reproductive technologies depended on one's view of marriage and procreation, and ultimately on one's worldview. Third, it raised questions about the authority and relevance of the Bible in a technological age, or more generally, how we are to discern what to do when the Bible doesn't explicitly tell us what to do. For instance, if we are to make disciples, teaching them to obey all that Jesus commanded, what do we teach them when there is no direct command from Jesus or elsewhere in the Bible regarding, for instance, the use of IVF? Is it simply an indifferent matter, so that God's will is indeterminate on that issue? If so, it may seem that the Bible offers little direct guidance on many contemporary issues. Instead, something of our task, and I would say the task of Christian ethics, may be seen in Paul's prayer for the Colossians, that they will increase in the knowledge of God's will in all spiritual wisdom and understanding, in order that they might walk in a manner worthy of the Lord. Moral obligation in Christian ethics is fundamentally related to discipleship. It is about a manner of life that is pleasing to God, whose will may be discerned through prayer and reflection on His word and His purposes, on the whole counsel of God when there is no explicit command. Concerning reproductive technologies, there has been significant debate among Christians as to whether they ought to be rejected altogether or embraced as good news for infertile couples. A case in point is found in Lammers and Verhey's book On Moral Medicine, a highly regarded text on theology and medical ethics, where the following two perspectives are presented in consecutive essays. On the one hand, Janet Dickey McDowell argues that conceptions via IVF ought not simply to be tolerated, they should be celebrated, for they enable otherwise infertile couples to join in passing along the gift of life. On the other hand, Paul Ramsey insists that in vitro fertilization and embryo transfer should not be allowed by medical policy or public policy in the United States. Not now, not ever. Does this suggest that the debate is interminable, that we are unable to draw any definite conclusions? What is the path of discipleship for infertile couples, and how should pastors and friends counsel them? In my view, it is not necessary to adopt Ramsey's complete rejection of IVF or other reproductive technologies, but neither should we accept their use without qualifications. Instead, by reflection on marriage, procreation, and infertility, it is possible to offer criteria by which to reject the use of some forms and to accept others as a possible means for infertile couples to have children. Before offering these criteria, it may be said briefly that the context for Christian reflection and deliberation on these issues should take account of at least three things. First, the promise of fruitfulness. Children are a gift from God to be desired, for procreation is a gracious blessing of the Creator and a central purpose of marriage. Second, the problem of infertility. Set against the background of fruitfulness as a blessing from God, Proverbs declares that the barren womb is never satisfied. Further, the Bible attests to the scorn experienced by barren women, such as Rachel, whose distress leads her to cry out to Jacob, "Give me children or I shall die." Pastoral counsel requires wisdom and sensitivity for the many couples, about 1 in 7 or so, who experience the same anguish. Third, the possibility of technological assistance for procreation. Advances in science and medicine make it possible for some infertile couples to have a child of their own. Yet technology must be held in check by moral limits that are at points difficult to define. For some, there seem to be no limits. The following cases are the stuff of headlines, what we might call extreme ARTs. Case 1. Junior and Mary Sue Davis had 7 embryos in frozen storage from IVF when they divorced. Mary Sue sought custody of the embryos in order to donate them to another couple. Junior did not want their children to be born after the marriage had ended. The court decided in his favor, and the embryos were destroyed. Case 2. Krista Yucatil was unable to carry a child, though her ovaries functioned normally. After IVF, using her eggs and her husband Kevin's sperm, Krista's mother, Arlette, served as a surrogate and gave birth to her own twin grandchildren. Case 3. When Kevin Cohen, an Israeli soldier, was killed in the Gaza Strip, his parents had his sperm extracted posthumously. After a 4-year legal battle, they won the right to impregnate a 25-year-old woman, chosen from over 200 women who had volunteered to help. Their lawyer declared it a boost for family rights. Case 4. Following 9 years of fertility treatment, a Romanian woman made headlines as the oldest woman to give birth at age 66 with the help of artificial insemination using donor sperm. Case 5, and this was just recently, this last year, Melanie Thernstrom and Michael Callahan went through 6 unsuccessful cycles of IVF. Undeterred, they used Michael's sperm and eggs from an anonymous donor to create embryos that were then placed for implantation in 2 different surrogate mothers. The babies, dubbed twiblings, were born 5 days apart. Now, Melanie, the mom, says she can't imagine having children any other way. And finally, and you may need charts and graphs for this one, James Allen Mack, Jr. was born to James and Linda. His paternal line is simple. James is his biological and social father. His maternal line is more complex. Linda, his mother, was unable to provide an egg or carry the child. So James' sister, Kathy, agreed to be a surrogate. However, she could not contribute the egg since she is the father's sister. So Linda's sister, Anne, was the egg donor. Thus, little Jimmy's gestational mother is his Aunt Kathy from his father's side. His genetic mother is his Aunt Anne from his mother's side, which means that his mother, Linda, is also his genetic aunt. These relationships are only slightly less complicated than those in the country song sung by Buck Owens entitled, "I'm My Own Grandpa." You'll have to look that one up. Indeed, such realities led one Christian ethicist to state, "We have in recent times multiplied significantly the occasions on which the question, 'Who are my mother and my brothers?' taken quite literally could have a use. Technology has made at least 9 combinations of parents possible with biological and social fathers, biological, social, and gestational mothers. The parental or family combinations are further expounded and compounded as reproductive technologies are used by single women and homosexual partners." Now, what can we learn from such cases? First, I want to make a point about ethics and moral reasoning. It should be said that there is a danger in highlighting extreme cases in ethics, for we may come to think that extreme cases are the stuff of which ethics consists and lose sight of the majority of situations that people actually face. For example, most of us will not have to decide whether to lie to Nazis who ask if we are hiding Jews, but we do face many circumstances that test whether we are truthful people. Most of us will not find ourselves in a sinking ship, short on lifeboats, having to decide whether to give the last spot to the theologian, the drunk who is passed out, or the nihilist philosopher who irritates everyone. However, we will have to decide whether we will be kind and just to those who mistreat us as well as to those who love us. Most of us will not have to decide whether to save the pregnant mother whose life is threatened if she doesn't get immediate cancer treatment, or the innocent child in utero whose life will be ended if she does. However, many women in a crisis pregnancy have to find courage and other moral resources to bear a child that was not planned and whose future, along with hers, is uncertain. The trouble with focusing on extreme cases of reproductive technologies is not unlike the problem with the color-coded advisory system developed by the newly formed Department of Homeland Security after 9/11 to indicate the terror or security threat level at any time. It consisted of 5 levels, including severe, which is red, high, is orange, elevated is yellow, guarded is blue, and low is green. One criticism of the system is that certain areas that are vulnerable, including, for instance, New York City and all domestic and international flights, are always listed at the highest level of alert. Consequently, it has been difficult to distinguish between different types of threats or to take any warnings seriously. As a result, it has been decided to discard the system altogether. Now, thinking about extreme cases of reproductive technologies has its place, for it provides the opportunity to consider not only the technology that makes such arrangements possible, but also the worldview and the understanding of marriage and parenthood that makes them thinkable, and to consider how our understanding and action might be different if governed by a Christian worldview. At the same time, a focus on extreme cases may distort our perspective, leading to a premature conclusion that all forms and uses of reproductive technology should be placed on a severe threat level and rejected altogether, a conclusion sometimes supported by simple truisms about technology being unnatural, or about trusting God, or not playing God. However, to reject all forms of technology may be to reject a good thing, which assists couples who otherwise are unable to experience the blessing of procreation. Further, it fails to differentiate between severe and low threat levels, and to help others do the same, including infertile couples who are seeking to follow Christ faithfully. We need wisdom to be able to assess the moral threat level of assisted reproductive technologies. A range of responses can be given to distinguish between forms that can be viewed as a low threat and accepted or embraced, those that should be treated as a high threat and rejected on moral grounds, and those that lie somewhere in between, where judgments concerning their use may be made based on a range of moral and or practical grounds. So first, a low threat level. Some forms of reproductive technologies that allow husband and wife to have a child together can be considered low threat. This includes drug therapies and surgical procedures that restore proper reproductive functioning, as well as intrauterine insemination and perhaps in vitro fertilization, when it avoids moral problems that will be discussed in a moment. Indeed, these can be celebrated along with other advances in medical technology. A couple may decide to avoid such procedures for practical reasons, such as the financial cost, or because the husband or wife considers the procedure to be burdensome or invasive, and there should be no sense of a procreative duty to pursue even morally unproblematic procedures. These are matters for the couple to consider together prayerfully and with appropriate counsel. Yet if assisted reproductive technologies present a possible good, which allows some couples to have children of their own, it is important to note that they are not an unqualified good. The following four high moral threat levels indicate ways in which the use of assisted reproductive technologies may be restricted. First, I will offer two moral principles for qualifying or rejecting some uses of reproductive technology, and then I will consider and reject two perspectives that drive or shape an understanding of reproductive technologies, with implications for understanding marriage and procreation. The first argument is that assisted reproductive technologies involve the destruction of human life. Assisted reproductive technologies that involve the destruction of human life should be rejected based on the sanctity of human life and the unique identity of each human being from the moment of fertilization. By this standard, IVF should be rejected, for instance, when it involves the creation of excess embryos, the grading of embryos to select those that are most healthy, the destruction of unhealthy embryos, and then selective reduction or abortion when multiple embryos implant in the womb. Even where destruction is not intended, as when excess embryos are frozen, we should be troubled not only by the significant loss of embryonic life in the freezing and thawing process, which has been around 50%, but also at the mass storage of human life itself. The fact that more than 400,000 embryos exist in frozen storage in the U.S. alone, and that it is considered a private or even a property matter with little controversy, is an indication of the disregard for human life at its beginning. Still, a rejection of IVF as it is commonly practiced leaves open the possibility of a morally responsible use of IVF, if only the number of eggs are fertilized that will be placed for implantation, and there is no intentional destruction after implantation, IVF may be considered morally acceptable, at least by the standard of the sanctity of human life. Of course, there may be other reasons for concern about IVF which must be considered. A second argument is based on a biblical account of marriage, particularly the principle of one flesh, and shaped by an understanding of the gospel. It will be articulated in response to the account offered by Stanley Grinz, an evangelical theologian and ethicist. He argues that collaborative reproduction, that is, the use of a third party through donor sperm or egg, or perhaps a surrogate, is not morally wrong, and indeed there may even be a compelling reason to use it, arising from the gospel and a call to sacrifice for one's spouse. Grinz's consideration of collaborative reproduction first examines the objection that it constitutes an adulterous act. He contends that it does not, since neither the intent to be unfaithful to one's marital vows nor the act of intercourse is present. He argues that such techniques do not introduce a third party directly into the marriage bond itself, as in adultery, but into the procreative process. As such, Grins contends, the only way to find technological procreation to be adulterous is to define adultery not as the willful violation of the covenant of sexual faithfulness, but as the violation of the assumed right of each spouse to become a parent only through the other. In Grin's view, collaborative reproduction is clearly not adulterous. Further, it should not be condemned on the basis of marital rights because the New Testament emphasizes not the claiming of rights, but the willingness to give up one's rights for the sake of the other. He appeals to the example of Jesus' sacrifice and asserts that a case can be made for practices involving donor sperm or egg within the context of marriage. His case is this: modern technological capabilities allow a married person, motivated by the desire to facilitate the wish of one's spouse to give birth to biological offspring, to choose willingly to set aside his or her right to be the sole means whereby the spouse is able to become a parent. The infertile spouse may consent to such a procedure, he says, since there is no intended or physical act of marital unfaithfulness, so that the fertile spouse is able to become the biological parent of their child. Now, Grin's argument for collaborative reproduction is somewhat unique and requires a more sustained response in that he makes a positive biblical and theological case as a possible implication of the gospel and a way of discipleship for an infertile couple. However, I don't find his case convincing, and I will assert that the gospel and the nature of marriage as one flesh implies that couples ought to avoid collaborative reproduction, and that Grin's presents an inadequate understanding of adultery, marital rights, and sacrifice. First, the question, is collaborative reproduction adultery? Grins thinks that it is not. Others agree. John and Paul Feinberg, for instance, suggest that while donor insemination may be ruled out on other grounds, it should not be considered adultery, since it does not involve a sexual act or lust or intimate contact with the donor. The woman does not forsake her husband for him. The procedure is not unitive, it is purely procreative. Likewise, Norm Geisler calls the charge of adultery far-fetched, since there is no sexual act with another man and no lust. This is crucial for his assessment, and he concludes that there is no moral reason to reject the use of a third party from a biblical perspective. Now, we may agree that collaborative techniques are not adultery, certainly not in the sense of a physical act or lust or the intent to be unfaithful. However, it is at least possible that an act is adulterous, that one spouse could forsake the other even without an explicit intent to be unfaithful. For example, if the purpose or telos of the seventh commandment is not merely to prohibit the act of adultery, but also to protect and promote the integrity of marriage, then various attacks on the integrity of marriage could be considered adulterous. Jesus declares that wrongful divorce and remarriage is adultery, and that lust is adultery of the heart. The teachers of the law might have argued that there is no explicit act or even intent to be unfaithful in such cases, but that would miss the point of Jesus' teaching about the nature of marriage and faithfulness. Certain acts and desires violate marital faithfulness simply by their nature, with or without the explicit intent to do so. If the use of a third party entails no conscious intent to be unfaithful, it may still strike at the mysterium of marital fellowship, as Helmut Thielicke puts it. Further, we may distinguish different aspects of intent. One relates to the aim or end of the act, which in this case is to have a child, not to be unfaithful. Yet another aspect of intent relates to the means, which is to bring a third party into the procreative act of marriage. By analogy, consider Sarai's offer of Hagar to Abram in Genesis 16. The intent is to procure a child for Abram and Sarai. Yet it can also be said that they intended to do so by the means of sexual union between Abram and Hagar. The explicit or conscious intent is not adultery, But that does not mean that the act is not adultery. While the act is different from collaborative reproduction, it illustrates the point that both aspects of intent, the end and the means, are relevant to the overall moral evaluation. It does not necessarily follow that the use of third parties is adulterous. However, the charge might not be far-fetched, as Geisler claims. Our judgment turns on whether collaborative reproduction is, as such, an attack on the integrity of marriage. Grins doesn't think so, for the third party is brought only into the procreative process and not directly into the marriage itself. Similarly, the Feinbergs argued that donor insemination is not unitive, but purely procreative. However, these claims, not to mention the act itself, are radical and represent a fundamental disconnection of procreation from the one flesh union of marriage. Further, the personal presence of the donor is denied, and his contribution is considered merely reproductive material. Yet this denial undermines the very thing that drives such procedures in the first place, that is, the biological connection between parent and child. In any case, donor insemination, if it is not technically adultery, it is worth noting that some have perceived it that way. One study revealed that for men whose wives were impregnated with donor sperm, I quote, "that sperm was emotionally equivalent to infidelity. Intellectually, they know that the sperm came in a test tube and was administered in an impersonal, technical way. However, their gut feelings were strong and disturbing." Closed quote. A second issue for Grins has to do with marital rights. Recall that Grins argued that there should be no assumed right to become a parent only through one's spouse, that the New Testament emphasizes a willingness to give up one's rights for the sake of another rather than to claim rights, and that an infertile spouse may set aside the supposed right to be the sole means whereby the spouse is able to become a parent so that the fertile spouse can have a biological child. I find Grin's account of rights in this case to be dubious. First, we may ask, why should we not assume that marriage implies having a child only with and through one spouse? That seems to be a reasonable implication of the nature of marriage as one flesh. Adoption is not an exception to this position, for in adoption, the couple becomes parents together. They do not have a child apart from one another. Second, while Grins appropriately says that a marriage relationship should not be based on competing rights, his conclusion that the infertile spouse can set aside the right to have a child only together is far from certain. Whether it is only a supposed right, as Grins indicates, or merely a desire, it is reasonable to affirm that it is something that belongs to marriage, which cannot simply be set aside by the consent to use of a third party. In any case, the issue of rights has not been eliminated, for it is implied that the fertile spouse has a right to a biologically related child, with or without his or her spouse. In response, I would say that the fertile spouse should not assert such a right. The infertile spouse should not be asked to step aside in order for the fertile spouse to have a child, not of their own, but of his or her own, with the help of a third party. Finally, to justify collaborative reproduction by appealing to Jesus' sacrifice, as Grins does, is also troubling. The example of Jesus encourages the strong to sacrifice on behalf of the weak. In the case of infertility, it is the infertile spouse who is more vulnerable or weak. And that vulnerability sometimes leads to an uneasy consent to the use of a third party. To quote another study, some husbands feel they have no right to deny their wives the experience of having a baby, even though they are opposed to donor insemination. Rather than expecting the infertile spouse to sacrifice so that the fertile spouse may have a child of his or her own, the model of sacrifice in the New Testament is better exemplified by the reverse. The fertile spouse ought to set aside the supposed right to have a child of his or her own for the sake of the infertile spouse. The biblical picture of marriage as one flesh involves not only sexual union and through it procreation, but also a life union of one man and one woman, for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, as traditional marriage vows state. This suggests, as indicated above, that husband and wife should have children only through one another, that they commit to share together the possibility not only of the joy of procreation, but also the burden of infertility. By refusing to bear children through some means other than his or her spouse, the one who is fertile can express the reality of marriage as one flesh, so that together they share the burden of not having a child of their one flesh. Indeed, to distinguish the fertile from the infertile spouse is itself problematic, for we ought not to speak of an infertile spouse, but rather an infertile couple. The one flesh principle does not rule out the use of assisted reproductive technologies as such, but only the use of collaborative reproduction. It remains to examine the perspectives that drive or shape an understanding of assisted reproduction. If we are not to be conformed to this world, but to be transformed by the renewing of our minds, as Paul says in Romans 12, we ought to consider and, I will argue, resist the framework within which much of the discussion takes place. John Robertson articulates that framework in his book, Children of Choice, where he defends virtually all forms of assisted reproduction. For Robertson, a professor of law at the University of Texas, the primary framework for evaluating such technology is procreative liberty, which he defines as the freedom either to have children or to avoid having them. While it is often expressed or realized in the context of a couple, he claims that it is first and foremost an individual interest. Though an individual may choose not to have children, Robertson argues that being deprived of the ability to reproduce prevents one from an experience that is central to individual identity and meaning in life. This identity and meaning is derived mainly from the ability to choose rather than from procreation itself, which is treated as a subjective value that is secondary to individual goals and choices. Procreative liberty is so strong that Robertson believes that the use of assisted reproductive technologies should be accorded the same high protection granted to coital reproduction. It may be limited where harm can be demonstrated. However, objections grounded in deontological principles or based on subjective moral convictions, such as the destruction of embryos or collaborative techniques, seldom meet the high standard necessary to limit procreative liberty. As a result, a couple or an individual should be free to pursue virtually any means available. Robertson's argument is relevant to any assessment of reproductive technologies, for according to Brent Waters, he provides a representative account of how procreation is now pursued, marking the cultural background against which Christian moral deliberation is conducted. Accordingly, this is a debate about more than the use of assisted reproduction. It is about competing accounts of morality. As Waters indicates, displacing a normative framework of marital and familial relationships in favor of one emphasizing individual interests and rights entails a collision of contending principles shaping subsequent moral deliberation. Robertson's case for procreative liberty represents an impoverished vision, or perhaps none at all, of marriage, procreation, and the family. It is with remarkable ease that he asserts that procreation is primarily an individual interest. Undaunted by the fact that natural necessity alone, for now anyway, requires the involvement of at least two people. It is equally remarkable that he is able to dismiss moral concerns as of little account in comparison to civil liberties, declaring that assisted reproductive technologies are to be accorded the same protection granted to coital reproduction. Against such a view, it must be asserted that procreative liberty cannot override significant moral concerns, and it cannot serve as a sufficient basis for the use of reproductive technologies. Rather, Christians ought to affirm what Waters calls procreative stewardship and challenge the understanding of procreation as an individual concern, as though having children is primarily about satisfying one's personal desires and needs. Procreation should be understood as an outward manifestation of the one flesh union of marriage in the one flesh of a child. Children are a gift to be received and loved, not a right to be pursued and chosen. This does not entail a rejection of assisted reproductive technologies as such, but a rejection of the framework of his argument. Driven by procreative liberty, it is difficult to know any limits at all to reproductive technologies, as Robertson himself demonstrates. The case studies presented earlier indicate that where procreative liberty is understood as a basic right, everything conceivable becomes reality, even if not ordinary, for there are few legal or moral regulations in place to prevent the use of any ARTs. The only limitation, other than current technology, is the willingness of those involved. That tells us much about how marriage and procreation are now conceived. And this raises the final concern. In addition to resisting the notion of procreative liberty, it is important to recognize the danger that the pursuit of assisted reproductive technologies can subtly shape and be shaped by an understanding of procreation in which children become a project of our making. It was perhaps inevitable, once fertilization was successfully accomplished outside the human body, that it would be described as assisted reproduction, using the language of manufacturing. By the way, it would be of some interest here that the first known use, at least according to the Oxford English Dictionary, of the term reproduction for procreation was written by John Wesley. But it was in 1782, not a word that he approved of, but a letter that he wrote complaining about its use, where he says that the person he was complaining about substitutes for the plain word generation, a quaint word of his own, reproduction, in order to level man not only with the beasts that perish, but with nettles or onions. It was perhaps inevitable. Instead of an unseen mystery that springs from the intimacy of a loving embrace, IVF allowed and perhaps even encouraged a different understanding of procreation, one which is more distant and sterile, which can be observed and over which we may gain control and mastery. The ability to manipulate the process makes it easy to think that we have loosened God's control over procreation and perhaps have taken it over. Indeed, R.G. Edwards, who was part of the first team to achieve in vitro fertilization, boldly remarked, and I quote, "I wanted to find out exactly who was in charge, whether it was God himself or whether it was scientists in the laboratory." And he concluded, "It was us." Once in control, we are prone to think we can even offer a better, healthier product of our choice and do it more efficiently, just as we have learned to manufacture everything else more efficiently. Perhaps it is even part of dominion and thus eminently human. So Joseph Fletcher claimed, "Laboratory reproduction is radically human compared to conception by ordinary heterosexual intercourse. It is willed, chosen, purposed, and controlled, and surely these are the traits that distinguish Homo sapiens." Fletcher demonstrates that technology is not merely a tool to help us pursue human goods, for it can even shape the way we think as we come to understand nature, even human nature, simply as raw material for us to mold in any way that we choose. Against such a background, we ought to affirm that children are begotten, not made, as Oliver O'Donovan has said. To the extent that assisted reproductive technologies cause us to forget that, they pose a threat. And such a mindset, if not the technology itself, ought to be resisted. Rather than being radically human, as Fletcher argues, such mastery over procreation may produce what Michael Banner calls a radical dissociation and alienation between parent and child. Even the control is deceptive, for it trades dependence on nature for a dependence on technology and the technician. If we make use of such technologies, we will need to remind ourselves and our contemporaries that children are not products of our making, but gifts of love to be received. It may be that few hold such radical views, or at least state the case so boldly, as do Edwards and Fletcher. Nevertheless, the language and methods of assisted reproduction ought to give us pause. We should not refuse all technology with the charge that it is playing God. Yet, especially given the hubris communicated by Edwards, we may heed the words of the late Paul Ramsey, who asked, "What does it mean, if indeed it means anything, to say that men should not play God before they have learned to be men, and that when they have learned to be men, they will not play God?" Technology can be used for great good, but it can also be destructive, and it is often difficult to discern one use from the other. Wisdom demands that we place certain limits on our making, and this is especially pertinent with regard to assisted reproductive technologies. But it is difficult to legislate moral wisdom. I have suggested that we should reject assisted reproductive technologies that involve destruction of embryonic life and that involve collaborative reproduction. In addition, we should reject a view of procreative liberty or technological mastery, which understand procreation to be primarily a matter of our will rather than a gift of love in marriage. This leaves open the door for forms of reproductive technology that can genuinely assist infertile couples to have children. We do well, in conclusion, to return to the theme of discipleship and to consider further implications of the gospel for our understanding of marriage, infertility, and assisted reproductive technology as followers of Christ. In doing so, we may recognize not only certain limits, but also opportunities that are a matter of moral wisdom. I hope that these will be words of encouragement, not only for infertile couples, but for friends and pastors who may minister to and alongside them, and for the church. First, we should again be reminded that infertility is a painful experience. A Harvard study showed that women with infertility experienced emotional distress at the level of cancer patients. This underscores what Proverbs says, that the barren womb is never satisfied. Instead of quickly offering simple, perhaps well-intentioned truisms about God's love and sovereignty, we ought to try to understand the hurt and care about and pray for and encourage those among us who long for the blessing of procreation that has not been realized. Second, we ought not to minimize the significance of a biological relationship between parent and child. It is a natural and good desire. Indeed, it is part of the divine order of creation, and some techniques that allow a married couple to have a child that is truly their own should be welcomed, not rejected out of hand. The biological relationship may be relativized, but it is not eradicated by the gospel or by an embrace of adoption, the significance of which is founded in part upon the natural parent-child relationship. Third, at the same time, as Stanley Hauerwas asserts, Christians understand parenthood in more than biological terms, for we are guided by a moral portrayal of parenting that cannot be biologically derived. An understanding of parenting may begin with the biological, yet it is expanded through adoption and further through parental roles, including teaching and many other ways of caring for children that can be assumed by those with or without children. Gilbert Mylander underscores the desperate measures that some will pursue to have a child of their own. And the tragic irony is that for some couples, the quest is deceptive, for with collaborative parenting, the child is biologically related to only one or even neither of the parents. Finally, infertile couples may be a powerful witness that ultimate hope is not founded upon having children. Isaiah 54, verse 1 declares, "Sing, O barren one, you who bore no child, break forth in song." These are, or should be, arresting words. How can the barren one sing? Isaiah does not minimize the distress of barrenness, and this should not be a trite word from a counselor. It is rather a profound implication of the gospel, precisely because it is set against the suffering of barrenness. The barren woman is exhorted to shout for joy despite the fact that she has borne no child, because something greater than procreation is coming, and for us, has come. Her fruit will be greater than the fertile woman, and her shame will be forgotten, for she is redeemed by God and belongs to the people of God. we can conclude with two implications. One implication is that a childless marriage can still be fruitful. This is important to recognize since a significant number of infertile couples will not have children even after pursuing reproductive technologies. We may distinguish what is central to marriage from what is essential to it. Procreation is a central purpose of marriage, and yet an infertile couple lacks nothing essential simply because they have no children. Childlessness can even be taken up into the redemptive purposes of God and open up possibilities that a couple would not have initially sought or embraced. By being detached from the usual patterns of life, a childless couple, like a single person, may testify to the fact that the present form of this world is passing away, and they may come to see their situation as an opportunity to serve the Lord in a unique way, as Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 7. A second implication that I will close with is that infertile couples have a place among the people of God. There is in this a call to the church to be a place of consolation and encouragement so that infertility may turn out to be not meaningless suffering, but an opportunity to receive and to be an agent of God's grace. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote that the physical presence of other Christians is a source of incomparable joy and strength to the believer. And may that be true of us in the church. We are challenged to realize that no one in the church is without family, for the church is family. The promise of Isaiah is echoed in Jesus' words that there is no one who has left house or brothers or sisters or mother or father or children or lands for my sake and for the gospel who will not receive 100-fold now in this time houses and brothers and sisters and mothers and children and lands along with persecutions and in the age to come eternal life. May infertile couples be able to experience and testify to that reality. Thank you.